Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today we're talking with Brooke Gladstone, author of The Influencing Machine, a book about the messy, human, biased, money-making, shareholder-pleasing, corporate-owned media, an ecosystem all of us swim around in and probably complain about. Welcome, Brooke.
For having me.
We're delighted to have you. Brooke has spent a couple of decades reporting on the media, first for NPR and later for WNYC in New York City, where she's been working since 2001. Brooke, I loved this description of On the Media, your show on WNYC. Brazenly shows how the journalism sausage is made.
Disgusting, right?
I love that, because that's so true. So no sacred cows, even with the media. You've spent a lot of time poking fun at them. And I also thought this, I read a lot of reviews of your book, read your book, loved your book. And one of them called it a frisky comic book primer that tackles objectivity, bias, and the lizard brain.
Yes.
And I loved that. I want to talk some about the lizard brain. So I want to say to our listeners, we invite you to call in with your questions for Brooke about media conspiracies, your frustration over local news, your suspicions about objectivity, or as Brooke has suggested in your talk last night that I heard was the great, great, great boredom with the news media that so many of us have today. And what's that about? So I'm going to throw out our numbers and then we'll start talking. If you're in Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8433. Or outside of Anchorage, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we also take email at hometownalaska@alaskapublic.org. And I invite you to visit our website, Alaska Public, because we've got some interesting links on there, links to your show, links to your manifesto, just various things about you if people want to learn a little bit more about Brooke. So first of all, I wanted to say, how's Alaska?
Oh my God, it's amazing. As far as I can tell, February has the best weather that anybody can imagine. Blazing blue skies, no piercing wind. New York has been a nightmare this winter. We're constantly digging ourselves out. So I'm going to be advising people come here for their tropical vacations.
You definitely had some nice days strung together. You got here Sunday?
Yeah.
And I think you're sticking around for the Iditarod start?
I absolutely am. When else am I ever going to see it?
Yeah. So that's great. That's a good thing that you got that. And the other thing I heard is you were like in classrooms back to back talking about journalism with students.
Yeah, journalism and writing and perception and cognition and the state of being human and the state of the media and how they interact and the future and the past. It's been a real roller coaster, and I have to say that the students are amazing. I mean, they are so engaged. I mean, it's quite possible that the hand-picked classes that I've gone to are just, you know, particularly terrific, but
they all had rock star before you.
Yeah,
came in or something.
I am awestruck.
Yeah, well, that's great. I also want to ask you about, you know, why did you do a comic book? Why did you do a book on the media? That makes sense because you've been covering the media, but I think I read that you really wanted to write a comic book more than you wanted to write a book on the media.
Right. In fact, I started wanting to write a science fiction comic book about two reporters working in the year 2042. I love science fiction. If anybody wants to call and talk about science fiction, I'm totally for it.
It's a call out, folks.
So I wanted to write that comic book, and actually DC Comics wanted to publish it. So we were able to, so I started writing the comic book, and I had these great characters, and I had great dialogue. But it turned out that I am really lousy at plotting my books. So I was kind of plotted into a corner, and my editor, DC Comics, said, you know, I have some suggestions, and they were brilliant, but they involved basically starting over. So I went kind of dark, and she's like emailing me, haven't heard from you in a month,
hello,
haven't
Brooke.
Heard from you in 2 months. Okay. And then finally she said, well, why don't you write a book about the media? And I thought, oh, no. Get thee from me, Satan. I really don't like media books. I get tons of them. They come in three flavors generally. Yeah. They're either really books that are hating liberals or hating conservatives, and it's pretending to be media analysis, but it's not. Or else it's a book that says, it's the collapse of civilization. The internet is turning us into beasts.
Yeah, yeah.
The end times. Or else it's people saying that, oh my God, we are facing a cyber utopia and all borders will disappear and all bound and time will disappear and we'll all communicate with each other and it'll be nothing but kumbaya. Just hold on. And I didn't like any of those and I didn't want to write it.
Throw them over your head. Right. Goodbye.
I did, actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would throw them against the wall and it would leave a little black trail of crud going down the side as
former,
they would pile up.
Former media books.
I didn't want to contribute to that pile. Yeah. I didn't want to write a book that I didn't want to read. But then I got around to it. Should I tell you what happened?
I want to. We have a caller, and mm-hmm. I really appreciate that they call in, so I like to bring them on. So
absolutely.
I'm going to welcome Chris. Hi, Chris. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for hosting the show. Appreciate this.
You're so welcome.
Sure. My question is, I'm glad Brooke's here, and I want to thank you very much. And I may be wrong in this, but over the years, I've just heard that the percentage of people who claim a liberal bias and a liberal orientation are so dominant, 80-90% of the media industry. I don't know if that's right or not, but it kind of rings true to me. And could you talk a little bit about the percentage of liberals and media in mainstream, liberals and conservatives in the mainstream media? Thanks, and I'll listen offline here.
Okay. You have to distinguish, I think, between the liberals and the nature of the coverage. I think that it is true that there are far more Democrats in media than Republicans. That isn't to say that the reporting is necessarily pro-Democrat. As a matter of fact, there have been plenty of studies from Pew and others who have determined that there are, that mainstream media, by certain criteria, actually will sometimes trend in the other direction.
Out of overcorrection?
it's what I call fairness bias. Mm-hmm. Not always. I know that we once made an effort a few years ago to determine if NPR had a liberal bias. And we went from study after study after study and finally settled down with Pew, that did the Pew Research Center, that did a study on this. And it found that NPR and public broadcasting tended to be straight in the center in terms of the kinds of stories they covered and the way that they covered them, that they were actually around where the Wall Street Journal was prior to its being owned by Rupert Murdoch, which was even then considered a conservative paper.
The NPR was like that Wall Street Journal?
Yeah, huh. In terms of the kinds of coverage they did. Now, I will say that, the Pew study talked about hot-button issues, and NPR isn't going to spend tons of time yelling about or covering these hot-button issues that create the kinds of heat that attract viewers to cable news frequently. So, they avoided some of those controversies and they spent a lot more time on foreign coverage, which isn't considered politically inflected. But the fact that news is produced by Democrats or people who are Democratic tend to be people who question authority and I don't think I'm making a huge leap here. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are kinds of people who like to do journalism. They tend to be, I'm not going to say Democrats are the people who...
Curious people.
Yeah. But they, leaving aside what their party affiliation is, they tend to question authority. They want to look into the underpinnings of something. They want to take it apart and, it is almost by definition not a conservative position to take if you want to
maintain
things to pieces.
Quo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so there is that. I'm not saying that they're better people or smarter people or more intellectually honest or anything like that.
But it's the way they tick. I mean, they want to take things apart.
Right.
Maybe.
And so, but the coverage, the liberal coverage, is a kind of a canard that was created really back in the Nixon administration. And every Republican administration has wanted to take money from public radio, even though many Democratic administrations, especially the Carter administration and the Clinton administration, would have been delighted if the subsidy for public broadcasting had been reduced. They didn't move in that direction. But there's nevertheless a sense that this liberal bias exists, and it is a rhetorical device, starting with Nixon, really, and has been propagated by some very powerful and very well-established think tanks on the right, the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute.
Yeah.
The left have been very slow to create similar think tanks. They're starting to be created to create a different narrative, but they are far behind at this point. And I think that many mainstream journalists feel excruciatingly self-conscious and will often bend in the other direction. In fact, a left-wing think tank looking at NPR found that they had many more conservative voices and Republican voices on the air than Democratic ones.
Wow. Well, you know, one of the things I liked about your book was we tend to live in the moment and we think everything is just this way now. And what I liked about your book was this long view that sort of showed... I mean, I was imagining that Sam Walton or Sam in 1798 was kind of like their Rush Limbaugh. I mean, he was very manipulative. He was very agenda-driven on what he was inciting people to do things. And
Sam Adams.
That's it.
Relative to the beer maker, but not the beer maker.
Not the beer maker. But it made me think, you know, his sort of modus operandi reminded me of, you know, AM radio, you know, inciting folks. And the other thing that I really loved about it was this notion that every government protects itself, and you just go through the presidents from, you know, Washington to Lincoln, who shut down 300 newspapers because of the Civil War, you know, Woodrow Wilson, all the way up, you know, Johnson and Nixon. Maybe they didn't actually shut down papers, but they made sure the FBI was investigating it. So are we surprised that we have a difficult relationship with Obama today? You know, I mean, he's just following what governments do. We may not like it, but I feel like taking that long view helps me understand what's going on today.
I think it maybe takes the edge off the sense of panic that some may feel about the polarized political debate and the rage that is generated by both sides. Yes, we've definitely been here before. And the media may contribute to the noise, but they're really more reflective. The polarized media is more reflective of the views of people who are already convinced. I don't think the media, like the cable news media that people are always yelling about, are all that influential on people who aren't convinced because they don't watch. They don't have huge audiences.
Right.
And even the mainstream network news, which have far greater audiences, are losing audiences and continue to lose audiences.
Yeah.
And basically, the people who are not that interested in it tend to be moderate, and they tend to turn off the news altogether.
Right, which was a point you made. You know, the vast majority of the country is moderate, you said, and the vast majority of them are terribly bored. They're not checking in. And I guess it's the rise of entertainment, the age of distraction. I think all of that is really, really interesting. And why do we want to check out?
Well, you know, when you look at this abundance of information and entertainment sources, then you realize that what the digital media have done and the, you know, hundreds of cable channels and all of that is to enable us to be more of who we were going to be anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So what studies have found is that the same percentage of people who were curious before the rise of digital media are better informed now than they ever were before. And the same people who were not interested and not terribly curious and looking for diversion are less informed than they were before.
Because they can find lots of it. Yeah.
They can create a world that in which they never accidentally encounter information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about this notion people say that, you know, people go to the echo, they go to their view and it reinforces them and makes them sort of more rigid? I mean, have you looked at that?
The echo chamber, yeah. And there's some chapters in the book. There's a term called homophily, which basically means birds of a feather flocking together.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, The internet enables us to create these locations where we feel safe and our views are never challenged. The problem is that when you enter one of those echo chambers, there is a phenomenon that occurs called, and I love this term, incestuous amplification.
Ooh.
And what happens is that if you go into, say, a liberal conclave, then the leftiest voices are the loudest and the moderate voices tend to be marginalized. And of course, the same thing happens on the right. And so there's a concern that the moderates don't find a place to go and that these loud, loud voices are creating an environment where even more polarization and even less ability to compromise is created.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to emphasize that studies suggest that these people were already converted. And it isn't turning the culture worse than it was before. It's merely serving those elements better than they were served before. And they tend to be really politically active. And given how our system is structured, they have an opportunity to influence elections and, create the kind of Congress that we have now, because they are active and because they are energized. So it's not that there's more people, it's that they have a greater ability to organize.
They're effective.
They are more effective, precisely.
Just touching on this history thing, the other thing I was thinking about is, we're in the middle of Snowden and to me, reading your book, you make the case of, the Supreme Court just saying, well, Daniel Ellsberg was just doing what the founders wanted him to do. Wouldn't you say the same thing of Snowden?
Well, it all depends on which part of Snowden you're looking at. The part that says, there seems to be an unconstitutional intrusion into our privacy that needs to be examined by the Congress and needs to be tested in the courts, that is precisely what the founders wanted us to do. Did the founders want us to basically disrupt any covert operations that we have abroad? Which he also, one of his leaks revealed that we were tracking the Taliban in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. This was a legal operation by one of our covert intelligence agencies. Snowden is fundamentally, judging from his own writings, a libertarian. He doesn't really believe that we should have undercover operations.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be hard to see what undercover operation he would really approve of. And so you have to consider that Snowden as well. I mean, Ellsberg, even when he took the Pentagon Papers, he first took them to members of Congress who
Senate.
Didn't want anything to do with them, right,
yeah.
The Senate. Then he went to the New York Times. He also withheld a couple of volumes that had to deal with ongoing operations. So he didn't just sort of dump it all out there. He was functioning as a clear whistleblower in every way, according to that
mm-hmm.
definition,
mm-hmm.
and he was prepared to go to jail for his civil disobedience.
Yeah.
So much of what Snowden did is, I think, important and valuable, but not everything.
Not
in my view.
Uh-huh. Yeah. If you're just tuning in, I just want to let you know this is Hometown Alaska, and you're listening to Brooke Gladstone, the author of a comic book called The Influencing Machine. And we're talking about the book, and I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I'd like to throw out our numbers for you. If you'd like to ask Brooke a question, 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752, or we'll take an email at hometownalaska@alaskapublic.org. So, okay. So it's always more complicated, right? Snowden is more complicated than Ellsberg.
That's right. It's always more complicated, darn it.
Yeah. I kind of want to ask you, it's a little bit like, what were the surprises from writing your book, or what did you learn from writing this book? That you didn't already know, because you've been studying the media for quite a while.
Yeah, but I learned so much. I mean, I knew lots of things vaguely, but I didn't know them definitively. I didn't understand about the significance of the Peter Zenger trial back in the days before we were a country.
Yeah.
I didn't understand the role of reducing the cost of mailing newspapers all over the place in order to tie the country together. I didn't thoroughly understand where this notion of objectivity came from and how long it had existed as a kind of golden aspiration in journalism. And what I learned is that it's a complete anomaly. It's only a mid-20th century phenomenon, really.
That was fascinating to me, yeah, because I thought it was the Holy Grail.
Right,
but
right.
No,
we managed to inform ourselves without ever for a moment pretending that objectivity could exist. And we know now. I mean, most of us are willing to concede that objectivity is something you leave to a computer. Human beings have to use judgment. Fairness is possible. Mm-hmm. And in fact, fairness is essential mm-hmm. for trust.
Yeah.
The idea that you can't form an opinion is just nonsense.
Right.
And, back at the beginning of American newspapers, they were published by professional guilds and political parties.
Right.
And, you know,
with agendas.
That's right. And they weren't pretending otherwise. And
right,
they cost 6 cents an issue, which was expensive, or you bought them by subscription and you were really paying out there. When the penny press started in the 1830s, they were supporting themselves through advertising, and the publishers of these tabloid papers, who were trying to appeal to recent immigrants and the working poor, were saying, we're going to be independent because we have ads, so we don't have to be...
So just charge a penny. Yeah.
But they weren't independent. They had very strong points of view that completely reflected their publishers.
Right. You know, Brooke, I'm going to go to the phone because we've got... Louise, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Hi. Brooke, we read your book in my book group, and all the women in it are over 50. And several people had trouble with the comic book format. They had trouble following it. I'm 56, and I had trouble with it, too, until I read the book Understanding Comics.
Oh, I am so glad you said that.
So do you feel like the format is appealing to younger readers more, and was that deliberate?
No, it wasn't a deliberate effort to appeal to younger viewers. Readers. I have to say, though, that I kept Understanding Comics, this magisterial, brilliant work by Scott McCloud, by my bed for the entire year that I was writing the book. It was my Bible, and I learned everything that I know from it. I am pushing, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be 59, so I'm older than your whole book group, probably.
And you wrote the book.
I wrote it. I did it, believe it or not, I did it because I wanted to use a medium that most approximated radio. And as counterintuitive as that sounds, being able to speak in balloons and look my reader in the eye, I thought could help approximate the kind of intimacy that listeners feel when they're being guided through a complicated subject by a host on the radio. The relationship to voices on the radio is very different from the voices on television, where they sound like they're talking to a huge group of people. It's like, today in Cairo, there was blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And, radio people, particularly public radio people, they tone it down a little. They're not speaking so loud. They're speaking in a way that feels like a one-on-one relationship is possible. You can almost feel their breath on your cheek. And, you know, there's something on radio. I'm going to do it right now. It's called the proximity effect. There was somebody who used to do this all the time on WNEW when I was growing up, where you lean into the mic and you go, hi, I'm Allison Steele, the night bird. And you feel like they are like whispering in your ear. That's called the proximity effect. And, in one way or another, that was a bit of an extreme example. There is that sense of intimacy. And I thought I could achieve that more with my natural voice in the comic book format. If you thought this comic book was complicated, there are some comic books that are incredibly complicated, which you know since you've read Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics, which I recommend to everybody. I think it's brilliant. I think go ahead. Sorry.
No, I thought it was a wonderful book. And when I told my 30-year-old son that I had trouble with the book, he said, read Understanding Comics. And then I saw that it was in your acknowledgment. So
this is a good book club.
Really led me to the right, book.
Did you find it easier after that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I was much more appreciative of the interaction of the graphics and the text and the narrator and everything.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Although I'm sorry you needed Scott McCloud to mediate the experience, but I'm grateful he was there.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Louise. That's interesting. I have to read the book. I have not read Understanding Comics. I struggled in the beginning, and I put it down, and then when I came back to it, I sailed right through it. I don't know what that was about.
Well, you know, I think that for many of us, it's just a form we're not familiar with. I actually had a long conversation with Art Spiegelman before I wrote this book. Mm-hmm. He said, first of all, don't collaborate. Collaborators will kill you. And, you know, but that wasn't possible for me because I don't draw very well.
You couldn't do the drawing and the story form, yeah.
But when you write, the difference between a comic book and an illustrated book is that in an illustrated book, the pictures support the text. But in a comic book, the pictures replace the text. So I had to write for Josh Neufeld, the illustrator, every single picture that I wanted. And I had to use, and so all the picture ideas, and there are about 1,000 of them, I came up with to replace text,
wow,
to provide context. So I'd send him like 300 words of description and a couple of reference links online and what I wanted in terms of text in the box, which would be like, you know, 35 words. And, you know, so the script for this book is like 10 times longer than the actual book.
This is harder than writing a regular book.
It is harder, but it's thrilling. It is really thrilling and wonderful for me to be able to think in visuals because I don't get to do that very often. You know, I try and do it in my writing a little bit, but, you know, there's only so much you can do. So that was really exciting. But it was all to create, because this book is not chronological, and I wanted to be able to take the reader on this journey. And the way to do that was to create a connection. And I thought that having the avatar of me leading them through the story did that.
Yeah, it's less lonely. you have a companion all along the way. Mm. So, and I guess I just gave into that. I think I was looking forward to your voice and sort of tell me how it is. What about this part, you know? So, that's really interesting. Is that a common remark you hear that people struggle a little bit with the story form or not?
You know, I haven't heard that, but I'm not surprised. Mm-hmm. You know, I know my husband, who is a journalist, was mystified for a long time that I was doing it this way and that I was so insistent on doing
it this way. Why?
And even, you know, some agents, when I had raised this years ago, said, you know, you'll really make a lot more money if you just do a regular book. I never intended it to be a textbook. It is being taught a lot. It's just a very concentrated argument. I thought pictures would make the argument stickier. And since it isn't chronological, I wanted to make it clearer. And I think once you sort of get past the barriers of being unfamiliar with it, it achieves a rhythm. And that's what Art Spiegelman helped me to do. He said, try to finish, you don't have to finish the chapters. You know, you have to finish your idea at the end of every page. Mm-hmm. So I tried really hard to make sure that whatever idea I was trying to craft would come to a transition point at the end of the page.
Interesting. Totally new form. I mean, you did bring the comfort zone of radio into this. You know, somehow you were able to think of yourself as a radio personality leading somebody through. That was a comfort, but everything else was not. It was all new turf. We've got another caller. I'm going to go to the phone. I'd like to welcome Jean on Hometown Alaska. Hi, Jean.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. I'm a huge fan of books. I listen to on the media all the time. Big fan of NPR. I'm what you might call a media junkie, not really a news junkie. Media, television, radio, magazines, the whole thing. And I'm more liberal, but I'm not real left, but I'm on the liberal side. But what I've always, because I've been liberal, I'm 60, but I have been liberal probably since I was 18. And what I always have in my mind, because I think that I'm liberal, which means that I see both sides of the issue. I'm open to all points of view, which I think is a lot different than somebody that's conservative. And I think mostly what they call conservative now is actually really right wing. But what I wish I could do is put myself in a conservative person's shoes and think the way they think to see how I think, but I can't do that. But where would I get a conservative, a real conservative opinion? Because Fox News, I think, is like way right wing. It's not conservative.
Right.
Who are your favorite conservatives?
Well, I'm not really sure. Probably who? Well, actually, right now it's kind of odd because we have our two senators, Lisa Murkowski and Begich, and I think they're actually more middle road. And Lisa Murkowski as a conservative, I probably generally kind of agree with her, but actually I think they're both moderates. It's just
yeah.
One says Democrat and one says Republican, but they're kind of both sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you read?
I don't really know too many conservative commentators.
Well, you know, I think what I would do is go to some of the more centrist websites, or even if you go to websites that trend towards the right, like, you know, National Review Online, they usually do have a range. I want to maybe dispute, there are conservatives that are not really super right-wing, but they just aren't given voice in a lot of the media outlets. In fact, most of the country is moderate. They trend towards the moderate right or the moderate left, and they aren't what you see or hear on Fox News, which is actually a great minority of the conservative the conservative wing of the party, I guess, or, you know, there. And there's a whole class of Republicans that trend towards the RIPON area, the moderate Republican area, as opposed to the extreme. But you don't see them in Congress, and that has a lot to do with the way that we elect our representatives today. I think that what I might do is look at the subject matter rather than at the stripe of the people. Like if you go to, say, Foreign Policy magazine, you'll find people online, you'll find people across the political spectrum that know something about a subject. And I think I'd begin with the subject and start examining the range rather than begin with the party affiliation or with the slant.
I think that's really smart, actually, Brooke. And I was going to ask you later, we're going to take a little break here in a moment, but in the second half hour, I really want to talk about the lizard brain, because
yes.
I was not expecting to see that in your book. And also a little bit about your media diet. You know, you were getting a little taste of it there just now. So you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy. Just take a 1 minute break.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I'm thrilled today to have Brooke Gladstone in the studio with us. We've been getting some really interesting calls. People really want to talk about the media. They love it. They hate it. They want to understand it. So we were just talking a little bit about media diets, but before we go there, I want to bring up the lizard brain, because that really interested me. I mean, the idea that we think we're making choices, but in fact, maybe we're just being biological creatures and we're responding to things without even really knowing it. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because you did a good job of that.
It was so fascinating to me. I spent tons of time on how we are ruled by impulses and by our little mental shortcuts and by our biases. And I listed a whole bunch of studies which I thought were fascinating, you know, right down to this great study where this person going down the hallway stops a test subject and, you know, he or she is fumbling with a bunch of stuff and hands that person either a hot cup of coffee or a cold cup of coffee while they fumble with their stuff. And then they ask the text subject, okay, here's this unknown person. Here's a description. How would you judge their personality? And the person who'd been handed the hot cup judged that person, that unknown person, more warmly than the person who was handed the cold cup. And on and on. I mean, there's just there's a bunch of really remarkable studies that have to do with how we are ruled by our impulses. You know that we have more neurons and nerves in our gut than we do in our brains, and we produce dopamine and serotonin from our guts, and they inform our brains. So sometimes we'll see something and it's our gut that reacts before our brain does. And there are studies that suggest that actually we've made a decision before we are even consciously aware of having made the decision.
That's so scary.
Which really calls into the question of, do we have free will? Can we function as purely rational beings? And we cannot. There was a wonderful case of a man whose emotion centers were completely disabled in his brain. He was like Mr. Spock, right? He could be purely logical. Well, that's not what happened. Mm-hmm. Because he couldn't judge things viscerally, or just because he couldn't act on impulse, he couldn't make a decision at all. He could be flummoxed for an entire day whether or not to choose the black pen or the blue pen. Well, the blue pen would be good because of blah, 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 but the black pen, maybe that kind of decision can't be made, much less breakfast cereal, much less a mate.
Yeah.
We have to function in the world as viscerally driven beings. But if we're aware of how that works, then we can sometimes bring our conscious mind to bear.
So help me with moving through the media landscape, reacting biologically as opposed to sort of reasonably, how is that affecting my choices? And what do you think about that?
We filter out the information that we don't want to hear. If we are forced to confront information that doesn't accord with our view of the world, and if, you know, the way we first react to it is by condemning the bearer of that
killing the messenger,
contradictory information, precisely. Uh-huh. When that doesn't work and the information is irrefutable, then you tinker with your worldview just enough to admit that little bit of information without letting it affect the rest.
Mm-hmm.
Because a person cannot be forever at sea. We mm-hmm. have to decide what we think about the world, and we have to admit change very slowly, very carefully.
Mm-hmm. I think you used the expression last night, it takes a lot of will. And
it
you
does.
Have to bring a lot of will to this problem. And many of us probably don't grasp the energy it takes.
Huge energy.
Yeah.
It is painful. It is painful to confront information
that you don't like.
That calls into question what we believe.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when I use the word will, I was actually quoting Soren Kierkegaard, who was basically saying, you know, you can live this conscious life where you're totally aware, or you can live with lies and evasions, and in the middle lies an act of will. Well, if it were only that simple, it's not, because we don't really understand how we function well enough to counteract those impulses.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to simplify our view of the world in order to live in it. We can't have a direct experience of the world. We must simplify.
Yeah. Or we'd be frozen. I mean,
that's right.
Yeah.
But we can be more honest, and we can understand what it is we tend to filter out, so that we can just push the door open just a little bit.
And chew a little bit on something new.
Right. You know, and break into our echo chambers and create opportunities for encounters with accidental encounters with information.
Yeah.
What computer geeks call serendipity. And they see a problem and they want to create serendipity engines. These are engines that will provide information that you otherwise would not encounter. that you might want to know. Mm. And there are certain sites that I really enjoy. We were talking about the media diet, like thebrowser.com or Three Quarks Daily or Arts and Literature, or I go to Wired, and I'll sometimes go to The New Scientist, stuff that I'm interested in. But mostly what I'm looking for are random bits and pieces of the world that I'll have missed.
Like a shiny object that grabs your attention. Yeah.
I really like that, and I think it's really true.
Yeah.
Another way to filter this information in a way that you can still find stuff that you didn't know you were interested in is to follow people on Twitter who you respect and who will generally connect you with links. I have to say that reporters use Twitter a lot, mm-hmm. and it isn't about what I had for breakfast, not at all.
No.
It's about using people with expertise, with judgment, who go into areas that you have a great interest in, but don't necessarily know where to go, who will vet stories for you and post them, link to them.
It's fabulous. It's like imagine having a little army of research librarians at your disposal with a topic that they're expert on and sending them out into the world. And then you pick up, you know, the tips from them. I mean, I think that's the best use of Twitter.
It absolutely is. And, you know, people talk about information overload. But as I mentioned in the book, how much information is there in a library? Tons.
And it's comforting to sit among it.
But if you dumped that out on the street, you wouldn't know how to deal with it. But we understand about the Dewey Decimal System. We understand about how to negotiate those hallowed halls.
Sorting, indexing.
Yes.
Yeah.
So how do we negotiate the information, you know, universe of the web? Well, you do it by finding new gatekeepers, because the old ones are starting to lose their luster and are not necessarily the ones who can tell you what you need to know.
Ah, well, I'm going to welcome another caller onto the show, Brooke. Hello, Carolyn.
Yes, this is Caroline. How are you doing?
Very good. How are you?
Excellent. You just mentioned in the last interchange a couple of words that I was going to bring up in my question. One, serendipity, and the other one is shiny objects. Years ago, when I worked in broadcast news, and that was ended that little trip in 79, one of the things that troubled me was it seemed that reporters chased after the same story. And this was before you had to get it on the air first, but the people were almost like pikas. I don't like the analogy of lemmings because they went off the cliff, but they chased after one shiny
birds
object,
of a feather.
And then another one would be there, and they'd go racing off after that, and it didn't seem that there was any substance. It was all the surface, and that was one of the things which caused me to get out of the business. And then the idea of being serendipitous. One of the things which has always driven me, my mother used to ask me why was I so contrary, and I took it as a compliment.
But for future reporter.
Being open. I want to be proven wrong, whatever opinion I have. And I think that people who are, you know, their ego is so, we're so pulled in based upon wanting to reaffirm ourselves and therefore what we know, that we do a lot of filtering. But the reporter that is always curious, and as Ms. Gladstone mentioned earlier, wanting to look under the curtain to find out what's going on is going to be the one that brings us something other than what we knew. How do we get back to that if we can, as reporters, as seekers of news?
Well, I would say, first of all, that reporters have always traveled in packs for the most part. I don't think that this is a recent phenomenon. And I also think that the desire to be first was, you know, something that dates back to the penny press as well. They just couldn't be quite as fast as they were before, but they traveled in packs. They followed big, brassy stories because they thought people were interested in them, and generally they were. So the question is now, because everything you need to know is probably out there, not what should reporters do. Reporters hopefully will respond to the market forces of people who consume the news and will do a better job if people want a better job. I think fundamentally, what you need to do now is to find the stuff, figure out how to find the stuff that is already out there, because I believe just about everything is. Mm. It needs to be vetted. It needs to be tested and trusted. You know, you might find a source of news and then maybe check all the facts in it to see whether or not it's a really well-reported story. And mostly you can nowadays, because almost everything is online. And then if you find it is, then you stay with that source of news for a while until you feel betrayed. And of course, ultimately, we are always betrayed because nobody is perfect. But I think that fundamentally, what you want to know is out there now.
It's on us.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, the truth is out there.
Yeah. Thank you, Caroline. I'm going to go to oh, go ahead. Did you have another comment?
I was just going to thank Ms. Gladstone for convincing me to do something I've resisted, and that's to become a Tweety Bird and on Twitter. The way
a convert right here on the show.
I am so proud, Caroline.
Follow Brooke. What's your
name? Oh, no, don't follow me. Follow On the Media.
Okay. Because,
I always do. I get your newsletter.
Oh, thank you. Email. Well, the Twitter feed is really cool.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Caroline. And I'd like to welcome Matt. Hi, Matt. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hi. Ms. Gladstone, thanks for coming up here. I haven't read your book, but I listen to your show when I can. And Caroline's question might have already addressed my concerns, but or my curiosity, but it all gets back to that whole how do you vet a news source in this mm-hmm. age of boutique media. I was a journalism student, and as I progressed, and I don't work in journalism, but as I progressed in my education and came to realize, wow, a lot of this stuff kind of gets fed to newspapers, and, you know, that was at the time you still had, you know, more newspapers and broader mm-hmm. diversification, but the actual business did that vetting. How does one do that as an individual? I mean, do you just look up Snopes or something?
You know, it's an excellent, excellent question, because, you know, I'm telling people, go out there and find this stuff, and you're saying, yeah, but how do we know what to trust? It is certainly true that a lot of the news we get, you know, a lot of science stories, for instance, on television are almost entirely funded and unacknowledged funding from various business interests that are interested in promoting their products. A lot of that stuff is real junk. And so the question is how do you know what to trust? And what I do, I think, is if I'm reading a story and there's a fact that sends my little antenna quivering, I will try and track it down. A lot of stories have links that you can follow, but you can like punch in the fact into Google and see the various sources that relate to it and try and track it down. There's a chapter in my book that talks a lot, that by example talks about how certain numbers get floated out there that are just absolutely wrong. Yeah, I talk about the number 50,000 and track its use in a particular context, and you can see the sort of crazy hall of mirrors that gave rise to this number being repeated over and over and over again, even though it had absolutely no basis in fact. I think the best thing to do is if you're reading a source that you've come to trust and there's something there that just strikes you as weird, re-report the story just one time. You can't do that with every story, but you are capable. Any well-reported story, you should be able to track that information or most of it down to its source material by punching the assertions into Google, pretty much. And if you can find a reasonable support for the information, then you know somebody who you're reading is a good reporter who's doing their job and is taking it. And you don't have to do it for every story. And, I mean, that would be crazy. Mm-hmm. But you might just try doing it for one, and then you can see whether or not that person's process is one that you trust.
Hmm. Good advice. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
You know, one of the things you said last night was, I mean, we're in this really rich environment. There's so much information floating out there. How do we sort it? But one thing you said last night was, you know, local news is just dying on the vine. And I kind of wanted to hear you talk a little bit more about that. Do you see any solutions? Do you think nonprofits might merge? I mean, I don't think you can leave it to to unpaid bloggers to go to city council meetings and stay till 11:30 and get that story on, you know. So what are we to do about local news?
There are communities where unpaid bloggers are actually doing just that, but I don't see how they can do it for long. I don't think they can sustain themselves. I think that fundamentally, where we see local news beginning to thrive is in areas where local businesses support it. This is a problem that really concerns the guardians of the news and mm-hmm. the media watchdogs. This is one of the few areas where you're not seeing the gaps being filled in by, you know, just people online, at least not in many communities. I mean, right. Ultimately, it has to be a choice of a community to support this news and a choice of community organizations and especially community businesses to get behind it.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to welcome another caller.
Mm-hmm, great.
Hi, Bob. You're listening to Hometown Alaska.
Hi. Thanks for having the guest you do. We are so honored in Alaska.
Wow. I'm honored to be here.
Brooke, I read a story that you did about your visit to Veracruz, Mexico.
Yes.
I spent several years in school there as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
In the 60s, when it was a much, much safer town, especially for journalists. And given that the drug cartels are murdering and then using as object lessons to other reporters, the reporters they torture and kill, how do you, as a person that wants to influence kids thinking about journalism, how would you approach a horrendous situation like that?
Well, you know, there are many of us who are committed to the profession that don't want to die. And then there are some who they don't want to die, but they are so committed to a particular story, either because it's happening in their communities, like the reporters that I spoke to in Veracruz, that they're willing to risk their lives. I mean, it's the Sinaloa cartel there that was causing the problems, and I think they may have apprehended the head of that cartel, but it almost doesn't matter because the government keeps passing laws to protect, in particular, journalists, to make killing a journalist a federal crime, which is, you know, nice, but they've never really apprehended anybody and charged them under that, not in the whole time that they've, in the several years that they passed that law. So you do literally take your life in your hands. When I'm, you know, I would never advise anybody, you know, go into a place where journalists are being targeted and killed. And it is the local journalists that are getting killed down there. They don't really care about foreign journalists. I mean, I was there in Veracruz, and they told us to be very concerned and to, you know, watch our backs, and they made us quite paranoid. But in the end, they don't care about us because we aren't the ones who are covering the corrupt local officials. We're just covering a general story. It's the local reporters that lose their lives. And, you know, I don't know what I would say. That's a choice that every human being has to make. Are you so committed that you are willing to put your life on the line every single day to just cover the police beat? It's not something that I would ever presume to prescribe to anybody else.
Mm. Thank you for the answer. Very thoughtful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. So I told you before that we were going to, I wanted to talk a little bit about optimism, and you said, oh, I don't know if I can be optimistic, but you're very optimistic. I mean, I kind of get an image of us living in a sort of primordial ooze of news possibilities, and that, you know, in the future, things will rise up as news sources that we have not seen before, because we're used to looking. I think this is Clay Shirky who says, we can't know what's coming because we define it by what we've seen in the past.
Right.
And I mean, I feel as if we're in an enormous reset of, and the media is part of that. I think all kinds of institutions are no longer adept, you know, not that they're crumbling, but they're not able to serve like they once did. And so people are just kind of taking the bull by the horns and doing their own thing. And that do-it-yourself culture is sweeping through everything. Even you, the woman who said, well, why don't reporters do a better job? And you're like, well, you can yourself. You know, I feel like that's, if there was a gross reset, it's that kind of our own sense of responsibility?
Well, yeah. You know, I think I mentioned in the book that it's kind of a caveat emptor world now. I mean, there was a time when we didn't pick our own pension plans and we didn't pick our own health plans and we didn't have to decide between paper or plastic in the grocery store and even, you know, how we were going to proceed with our cancer treatments if we needed them. And now that's a time where all of those things are put before us, and every single one of those decisions demands a conscious thought. It's hard to live in a DIY, caveat emptor, buyer beware world. It's mm-hmm. complicated, and it makes us want to take shortcuts. And I think we should where we can, mm-hmm. and we cling to the people who we trust, but maybe not terminally. Mm-hmm. There are times when we have to examine periodically the choices that we've made in order to make the best choices for ourselves, and that has everything to do with what we put in our mouths and what we put in our brains.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who talk about the decline of civil discourse, and I wonder where you are. Do you see it sort of, again, hell in a handbasket, you know, we can't even talk to each other anymore? Or do you see it as just kind of this vital give and take and pick and choose and be smart about what you listen to? I mean, where do you come down on that?
I think we live in a less civil culture at the moment. And I think this is one of those moments that go in cycles, having to do with the historical moment and our coping with this particular kind of technology. Like I said, the mid-century America was a very civil time, and that's a very long story, but there are reasons for that anomaly. And we haven't always been so civil as we were then, and if anything, we're probably reverting to an earlier time, and maybe the cycle will turn again.
We just have about 2 minutes left, and I'm going to invite Susan on for a very quick question. Susan?
Yes. I was really heartened with the Anchorage Daily News series that they're doing on FAS. It seems like the Daily News of old doing big stories, but I also found out that it's got some funding to help them do that, and I'd like you to comment on the potential role of that kind of funding to help news.
Well,
came up last night.
It was, and oh, so this was information. This was reporting that was
funded,
provided by money from a foundation.
That's correct.
And you know, that may very well be the future of the kind of reporting that you'll see on the local level. And it is true that foundations are going to have to step in, not just with nonprofits. Maybe they're going to have to spread their benefits to profitable institutions too, or maybe those institutions should become nonprofits.
So, thank you, Susan. We're just about out of time. I did want to give Brooke just one chance to leave something with our audience, something short, something maybe optimistic or maybe know thyself. What would you leave them with?
I guess I would leave them with, you know, this is really a great time to be alive for all the reasons you say. I mean, our politics are horrible. Our institutions are in crisis. But there's so much that's being reinvented, and there's so much that's at your fingertips. And there's so much to enjoy and imbibe in this era. And I would just, you know, look at it that way, as this vast smorgasbord. You'll never be able to eat all of it.
So don't give up. Jump in and swim.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm going to stop there. I'm going to thank you so much. We've had a really, really lovely talk.
I did too. Thank
Lots
you.
Lots of interesting conversation with listeners. I really appreciate it. So thank you, Brooke Gladstone, for coming all the way from New York City to spend time with us in Anchorage, Alaska. Next week, I'll be back again as your host on Hometown Alaska. We're going to be talking about old pets and when you know that it's time.
Aww.
which is why I want to do the story. Let's see, and we'll have a guest, a veterinarian, on with me. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Go Sea Wolves!
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.